versus the Morgan Bank. Mr. Falk.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Steve Falk. I am here from Indianapolis, Indiana, representing the appellants Classic Cheesecake Company, Heartland Foods, Danny Woods, and Karen Curry. There is another individual who was an original plaintiff named Kia Macon. We do not represent her interest in this matter. We come before the Court this morning to raise a singular issue in the case of an oral offer to extend credit. That is, as a matter of law, without factual analysis, development, or adjudication on the merits, did the appellants plead injuries caused by the appellee bank, J.P. Morgan, which was at the time Bank One, that are substantial and independent enough, or substantial or independent enough, as I'll get to in a second, to remove their state law equitable claims from the operation of Indiana Statute of Frauds, which prohibits actions on unwritten offers to extend credit. The appellants, whom I represent, minus Ms. Macon, have so pleaded and did so at the very beginning of this action. We're requesting the Court to reverse the trial court's dismissal of the state law equitable claims.
That exception, that unjust and unconscionable, isn't that designed for a situation where the party that broke the oral agreement made some money from it?
Your Honor, there is within the elements of constructive fraud, there is an element that says that the individual who had a duty with respect to the complaining party needs to have shown some benefit, that there is no similar requirement that I'm aware of for actual fraud or for promissory estoppel.
What's the actual fraud? There's no benefit to the bank from this. She obviously, you know, was overconfident about the approval.
Right. And, Your Honor, that may be...
It wasn't fraud in a sense of taking money from your clients, hurt your clients, but it's not that the bank profited from this.
Actually, Your Honor, I disagree. The rule that Your Honor is citing might have some application to constructive fraud.
You disagree that when I said the bank didn't profit from this?
No, I'm disagreeing that constructive fraud is the only action, the only state law equitable claim that has as one of its elements the requirement to show that there was some benefit to the party that owed a duty to the party who's complaining. But with respect to actual fraud...
Benefit. How is this any different from any statute of frauds problem?
How this is different, Your Honor...
About this case.
How this is different, Your Honor, is that we have a situation where a bank officer, over the course of 77 days...
What does that have to do with anything? It's a bank officer. You have an oral agreement... It's governed by the statute of frauds, so there's no liability. Now, there's this unjust and unconscionable exception. What's the closest case you have to this case?
Sure. And, Your Honor, I use the phrase bank officer merely as an appellation and not as any type of pernicious...
What's the best case you have in Indiana?
The best case that we have is the most recent case on this issue to come out of the Indiana Supreme Court, which is... Coca-Cola versus Baby Backs has been referred to within the jurisprudence as Baby Backs. This case stands for...
What would happen in that case?
In this case, there were actually several different parties that brought...
It's simple. What happened that was unjust and unconscionable?
A situation where Baby Backs, they make ribs and barbecue products, were wanting to put their things alongside Coke products in various stores, first in Indiana and then outside of Indiana. And the Indiana Supreme Court, it's pretty complicated with the different parties involved, but the Indiana Supreme Court came back to this issue about...
You still haven't told me what happened. What was unjust or inequitable about the conduct of the defendant in that case?
In this case?
Baby Back's case, your best case.
In the Baby Back's case, the company Baby Back's was making, again, with respect to Coca-Cola, which is CCE, they made the claim that there should have been an enforced oral agreement to continue to require the expense and time of putting these products together all over the country, basically. The court came back, looked at a bunch of communications with respect to the negotiations and said, actually, there was no agreement on this point. The communications show very specifically that Baby Back's had not reached a substantial agreement, a meeting of the minds with Coca-Cola. And Coke was very quick to point that out to them, which is another point of distinction from the case that is before the court today. In our case, we have a situation of 77 days.
Trust me. So was the oral agreement enforced in Baby Back's?
No, it was not.
Well, I asked you, what is the best case for... best case in which an Indiana court held that there was unjust and inequitable conduct that allowed one to ignore the statute of frauds?
Okay, now I understand that differently, Your Honor. I thought you were looking for the most recent authority when you asked the first time. Actually, all of the cases that have come down...
Give me one case that's close to this, that's your best case.
Baby Back's requires a factual finding.
You don't understand me at all. I must be really unclear today. I'm not interested in the most recent case. I'm not interested in general judicial language. I want you to tell me the case in which an Indiana court found unjust and inequitable conduct so that the statute of frauds would not be enforced. The best case for you, the strongest case, so we get some concrete idea of what the Indiana courts understand by unjust and inequitable conduct.
Sure, Your Honor. Let me answer that by pointing out a very key procedural point.
No. I want you to give me the best case in which they've found unjust and inequitable conduct.
Your Honor, we're here on a motion to dismiss. So a factual review is what my clients...
You're refusing to answer my question.
No, I'm trying to answer your
question. Go on to something else. I asked you something very simple. What's the case that's held, that's found unjust and inequitable conduct?
There are no cases that have expressly said that. However, that's not the ultimate issue that's before the court today.
You've lost me completely.
Okay.
You mean you have no precedent? Has an Indiana court never found unjust and inequitable conduct sufficient to lift the statute of frauds?
The Indiana courts have consistently found that these types of complaints should not be dismissed as a matter of law. And that's what happened to my client's complaint. And that's what we're here today to complain about and ask the court to reverse.
So in other words, no one has ever won a case like this before?
That I don't know, but I can tell you that in Indiana jurisprudence, they have all allowed them to go forward to fact-finding, not dismiss them as a matter of law.
Okay, before you sit down, you started off by saying that you do not represent Ms. Macon here.
Right.
Was she the beneficiary of the jury verdict on the federal claim?
The beneficiary of the jury verdict was Classic Cheesecake Company. They were found to be...
Why isn't she still involved? I mean, she's the one that had the student loans and all that stuff.
She's not involved because she received her student loans being paid off. And there is some really tedious interpersonal history that I don't think it bears on the relevance of this. But I can say, Your Honor, that because of the financial strife that fell out of this, that's what caused the parties to cease doing business with one another. If I may reserve the remainder of my comments.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Fall. Right. Mr.
Thank you,
Brown.
Your Honor.
Thank you and good morning. I'm Alan Brown, representing the defendant appellee, J.P. Morgan Chase Bank, N.A. I think the court has correctly discerned that, in fact, there are no Indiana cases that afford the type of relief that the plaintiffs seek in this case. Referring specifically to the Baby Back case, I would comment if that's the best they have, then they are, in fact, in trouble. That case does not say in any way, shape, or form what constitutes separate, independent, unconscionable injury, because it doesn't find promissory estoppel applicable, and it finds that for a separate reason. It finds that there was no proof of reasonable reliance, and it says absolutely nothing about what it takes to constitute unjust, unconscionable injury. In fact, in dicta in that case, the court observes that the damages claimed, which are the types of damages plaintiffs seek in this case, which are business expenses, lost profits, lost business opportunity, the court comments that it may not be independent from the benefit of the bargain. So, in fact, it offers some criticism and then moves on to decide the case on other grounds. Now, the two cases that are appropriate for the court to consider start with the 1997 case of Ohio Valley Plastics versus National City Bank, which is the first case that ever took on the applicability of the Indiana bank loan statute of frauds. And here's what that case held. It held that the statute applies no matter how the claim is labeled, whether you denominate it as fraud, constructive fraud, promissory estoppel, however you please. If it's fundamentally about a bank oral agreement to loan money, the statute of fraud applies. That case then holds that equitable theories do not operate to remove the case from the statute of fraud. It then goes on to hold that the benefit of the bargain, incidental expenses, reliance damages like lost business, are not recoverable under the promissory estoppel claim. And it goes on to say at page 264 that, in fact, the types of reliance damages that are typically recoverable in promissory estoppel do not appear to be available in this kind of a case where the statute of frauds applies. Now, this leads to a question which I've been trying to answer, and I don't think I have an answer, but if one juxtaposes the promissory estoppel damages that are available versus what a string of plaintiffs have attempted to claim in order to fit into this exception, they stack up pretty nicely. When you look at what one might be able to recover under promissory estoppel, one thinks primarily of the reliance damages, as in, you promised me you would do this deal, so you must convey the land, you must make the loan, I must use the proceeds from that particular transaction to go forth and do my business. And plaintiff after plaintiff has marched into Indiana courts in an effort to try to sell that, and every time they've been shot down. Now, if we march forward to the most recent case, which is the Spring Hill Developers case versus Brinkworth, which was decided in January of 2008, that case takes a very nice look at the long line of promissory estoppel cases, and in particular the efforts to prove this unconscionable and unjust injury piece. It considers the two most recent Indiana Supreme Court cases, which is Brown versus Branch in 2003 and the Baby Back case that Mr. Folk made reference to, which is a 2006 decision. And it says this. It says, to be unconscionable, reliance injury must be independent from the benefit of the bargain and resulting expenses and inconvenience, and it must be so substantial as to constitute an unjust and unconscionable injury. Now, what was the context?
Has anyone given an example of what might be a good case within this exception?
Your Honor, I can't answer that question because the courts in Indiana have done a fine job of telling us what it isn't. They have done a poor job of telling us what it is, and plaintiffs, for whatever reason, have not been able to find the silver bullet to tuck into that loophole.
Is this some common law doctrine, or is it part of the bank statute of fraud statutes?
You know, its origin, Your Honor, goes back to a case from about 1947, the name of which escapes me right now, involving the sale of cattle, where the price went up. And in Crawfordsville, Indiana, cattle sold for less than Chicago, and they brought the cattle up here. And in the course of that, they claimed that the effect was so profound that the oral agreement to sell these cattle should be enforced. And in what I consider to be basically dicta, it was thrown into that case that only in cases where the damage is so unjust and unconscionable as to shock the conscience should, in fact, promissory estoppel overcome the statute of frauds.
So is this just an Indiana, as far as you know, maybe you haven't looked outside Indiana, but Is it a general statute of frauds exception or unique?
I can't answer that, Your Honor.
Right. Mr. Brown, are you familiar with the case of Madison Tulin Dye versus C.F. Sachs Auto, Southern District of Indiana?
I am, Your Honor. I believe that's Judge Tinder's case.
Now, isn't that a case where the court did find a substantially...
I think not ultimately, Your Honor. That was a case where a summary judgment was survived by a claim that, in fact, the purchase of a very large piece of equipment and the business that won. I won't belabor that. Judge Tinder did let it go to trial. The case was then tried on bench trial. Mm-hmm. The ultimate finding of fact was that did not qualify.
No, I appreciate that. But that's sort of a factual example, I guess. Isn't that what Judge Posner has been looking for from counsels?
Perhaps. But, again, I think the key point is ultimately when Judge Tinder, who also made the summary judgment ruling, heard the evidence, he too found it. If I might just tie this up with a final comment on the Spring Hill case, because I do think it really drives the outcome in this case. Spring Hill was a case where a owner of land reneged on a development contract. A couple of families had gone in on the idea of developing land. Due to some complications relating to sewage treatment, the deal never came to fruition. And the disappointed partner, who was not the owner of the land, sued claiming unjust and unconscionable injury, claiming that the failure to convey the land was an unjust and unconscionable injury, that the substantial amount of time, effort, and expenses that the development project had expended, and the lost profits they were going to get from the sale, the ultimate sale of the developed land, was in fact unjust and unconscionable. And in that case, upholding summary judgment, the Indiana Court of Appeals held not good enough. Those damages are exactly of the type that we're presented with here. Their contention is that we didn't make the loan, that in anticipation that the loan would be made, they funded the business, and that they had expectations of profits. And just as the Spring Hill Court and Ohio Valley Plastics Courts denied that as unjust and unconscionable, Judge Lawrence's decision should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brown. So, Mr. Falk, do you have any time? A minute?
Thank you, Your Honor. It is important to note that we're not here on summary judgment. There was not a factual investigation into any of this. And the case that, if we can understand that context together, the case that is most clearly instructive about what to do with a complaint that's been kicked out on its bare pleadings is Keating versus Burton, 545 Northeast 2nd 35. Where a similar complaint was dismissed by the trial court as being allegedly within the statute of frauds and unsavable, and the Indiana Court of Appeals said, no, this is a pleading, you take it.
Is this cited in your brief?
It is.
What's the name of it?
Keating versus Burton.
K?
K. Keating. There is also a reference to that with respect to two of the other cases.
Well, actually cited in your brief. At least it's not in the table of contents. So what is that citation?
It's 545 Northeast 2nd 35. And if that somehow escaped our list, I apologize about that. But it is in the brief because that's where I pulled this from. If I may finish my thought. That case was kicked out notwithstanding well-pleaded allegations that are supposed to be taken as true on the issue of a motion to dismiss. And the plaintiffs in our case...
So what were the allegations?
The allegations were breach of contract and failure to honor an option to purchase. And basically the opinion itself is just a recitation of the complaint. And
what was the unjust and inequitable conduct that was charged?
The unjust and inequitable conduct is that this was an oral agreement. The oral agreement, according to the moving party, was within the statute of frauds, and the district court or the trial court in Indiana State Court kicked it out. The Court of Appeals said you have to look at the...
Yes, but what was it that the What was it that the plaintiff was arguing was unjust and inequitable or inequitable that would justify enforcing the oral agreement?
The plaintiff was asking for a judgment for damage that he suffered by reason of the breach of the agreement with respect to Mechanical's failure to honor the agreement.
Well, of course, but what was the unjust and inequitable behavior alleged?
The unjust and equitable behavior was it didn't go into that any further, Your Honor. That's
look, I don't know what you're talking about. You can't just say, well, we have an oral agreement and it's governed by the statute of frauds, but I'd like to enforce it anyway because it would be better for me. You can't do that. You have to say, well, this falls within this exception for unjust or inequitable behavior. There must have been some allegation of that sort in Canada.
I agree, Your Honor. And
so what was the allegation?
Well,
what made it unjust?
It's not specific. I agree with counsel that our courts have done a good job of saying what things aren't. And this case doesn't say what was the case either. But what this case does do, without nearly the same detail that the appellants have in their complaint, is to say this is within unjust and unconscionable injury, should be accepted from the statute of frauds, and the Indiana Court of Appeals accepted that and reinstated the complaint. On a motion to dismiss, the Indiana Court of Appeals, as well as all the other cases, and I'm not making that up, every other case has proceeded to either summary judgment or trial.
You're saying that a suit to enforce an oral agreement can never be dismissed on the basis of the statute of frauds because there's always a possibility that it might be unjust and inequitable to do that? Is that what
that's
you're
correct,
saying?
Your Honor. There is no
well, that may be some Indiana pleading rule. That's not how we do it.
Well, there is no literally what the bank has is no authority supporting the idea that these things should be dismissed as a matter of law.
Did spoke in, I don't have baby back with me, but I understand the sweep of the analysis this Indiana Supreme Court had. Was this case included in that analysis? Is Keating to be found in baby back?
Baby back's proceeded to a summary judgment and a fact-finding and adjudication. I don't think that Keating was exactly on point about that. I don't think that the Supreme Court...
Has Keating ever been cited, let me ask you this, by the Indiana Supreme Court?
Not recently. I don't have the Shepherd's
and
right
of course,
off the top of
And,
my
of course,
head.
In Keating, there, we had a contract in addition, right? I mean, a written contract. From what I understand...
Oral contract. That's why it was within the statute.
No, I understand there was an oral, but didn't you say there was also a written contract?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Okay.
But with respect to the difference there, Baby Backs had this opportunity for the case to be fleshed out, and it was resolved on summary judgment. Even though the bank in this case was found to have violated the Equal Credit Opportunity Act for predatory lending practices, we've not had the opportunity to raise the other side of this, which is fraud, and we ask the court for the opportunity to do that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Elk and Mr. Brown. Next case for our